So suppose you are starting a test on Friday and suddenly on the weekend it is performing very well. So you let that test, all those tests that were started on Friday, you let them run. Those that were started on a Monday or a Tuesday, which had an initial downfall, then you don't let them run. So there is a bias to that as well. So that is why I generally condemn that practice. And the idea, I think, which has become accepted in the industry is let tests run for 2 weeks. But I also accept and say that if there are some crucial stakes involved, like for instance, if you understand why the performance is bad, or you have some crucial guardrail metric being hurt very bad, then you should go ahead and stop them. But it should not be a general practice.
G'day folks, it's Richard here from the Experiment Nation podcast. Today I've got a guest on the platform. It is Ishan Goel, who's a Associate Director of Data Science at VWO. Thanks for being on the podcast. Really excited to have you here. I've chatted to a few statistical, intelligently brainy people way bigger than my paycheck. And every time I interview technically inclined people like yourself, I've always got to do a bit of research so I don't come across as too thick on the air. But anyway, look, it's good to have you on the air, specifically since, you know, you're heavily invested in VWO, and, you know, you're involved in the statistical engine and so forth. So you've got both good theoretical experience, but also very good practical experience in, you know, statistics and, well, applied statistics within experimentation. So look, before we talk about like all things stats and all those sort of things, look, why don't we just talk a little bit about your background? You've got an interesting background. You study computer science?
I studied computer science for my bachelor's, yeah.
Great, great. And what was your attraction to do computer science? Like, were you always involved in computers as a child? Did you like programming? What was there anything particular there that you caught your eye?
That's what we are told to write in our statements of purpose. But what really happens in India is that a lot of people are guided towards the engineering field. Yeah. And it's just sort of like... Yeah, I really did not make a conscious choice before going there, but it somehow turned out to be that I landed myself in an engineering college and then I started enjoying computer science and stuff. So it was more reverse engineered that ways.
It's sort of like, India's very culturally inclined towards IT, right? Like, I mean, I think it was it Mumbai? What's the ICT?
Bangalore.
Yeah, it's like you're kind of like they're pumping up computer science grads everywhere, and there's a lot of like development work there and stuff. So cool. You went to study comp sci for a few years, and then you studied a master's in North Carolina State University. What was your motivation to A, do a master's, and B, study overseas in a Western university?
So essentially, one, when I was trying to enter the data science field in 2016, just after my bachelor's, I was finding it difficult to really justify like science and research-based roles without having done a master's degree where you get more exposure to research. Although I was researching on the side, but I was finding it difficult to really get into the industry and stuff at that time. So my first motivation was to get a master's, and a US master's at that time was like really valuable for the experience and the sort of, they were spearheading the data science field and stuff. So that's the reason I went to the US. And I found it to be a very interesting experience.
And I'm sure it'll kind of open up your eyes to other experiences, because it looks like you started off as a software engineer graduate and then you sort of made your way into more kind of like data science and then experimentation specifically. Can you elaborate on that, please?
So it's been an interesting journey. Like, first year of my WorkX, I was working as a software engineer. Then, interestingly, I landed myself into statistics research and causal inference. And surprisingly, the field was not even up at that time. I was working on a problem in causal inference. Somehow, 3 years down the line, I landed on a very related problem when I joined VWO. So it was just by chance that I landed on the experimentation problem and statistical significance. And then ever since I got into the research, into that, whatever I'd learned, that sort of compounded there by chance, and I started enjoying the field a lot. So that's how I landed into experimentation.
And I guess it's sort of like, it's quite a, I think it's for a lot of people that get into experimentation, I think, you know, like it's sort of something they just stumble into, isn't it? Like, I went to uni 20 years ago, and it was obviously not something that was existed at uni, like the idea of experimentation as a job. I'm pretty sure you can't major in it, but a lot of the people that I bump into in this world, they just sort of come across it. They might come across it from a background like yourself, or they bump into it as an analyst, and then they get into the kind of more the A/B testing and, you know, sort of part of it. And then, but yeah, or then they can even come across from a more of a psychological background. So, everyone's got different sort of pathways, and so it's good. It's good that you've explained that, because there might be someone who wants to be a data scientist and doesn't know what experimentation is. So maybe if they're listening to this podcast, maybe you can inspire them to, you know, go down that path. Let's talk about some statistical sort of concepts. I think the first one we're going to talk about, and this is something I'm not really that familiar with myself, is the multiple comparison problem in statistics. Can you explain what that is in very simple terms to our audiences, and why you think that, what's the significance of understanding this within experimentation?
I'll start with a very interesting story and an intuitive story about multiple comparison problem. And it's sort of like a general phenomena of statistics and a general intuition that works in probabilistic things. So this is an extreme example, but imagine, and this is from Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, The Black Swan.
Oh.
So he says that imagine that there are an infinite amount of monkeys sitting on infinite amount of typewriters, and everyone is just randomly keying in something.
Yeah.
So if the monkeys and the typewriters, they are infinite, there is definitely a chance that someone will come up and write the Odyssey or the Iliad, that one monkey will be there just randomly keying in, and he will come in with the, he'll present the Odyssey and or the Iliad just by chance. So the idea there is that if the pool is big enough, then any even smallest probability of event is likely to happen. And that's just the fundamental intuition that goes on to statistics. So if you are picking out from a random pool and the pool is very big, you should expect to see more and more uncommon patterns in data to emerge out, sort of. So that is the fundamental intuition that's behind this multiple comparison problem.
Well, it says here in the definition, this is the pre-show notes, by the way, the definition you've given here for me is whenever you have more than one hypothesis being tested in an experiment, again, the chances of getting a false positive increases in the test.
Yeah.
Hence, whenever you are testing more than one hypothesis, you need to be conservative with the desired statistical significance in the test result.
Yeah, when you apply this to an idea in general, in experimentation, this fundamental intuition, what happens is that whenever in an experiment you are sort of testing more than one hypothesis, so like that's one implication of the multiple comparison problem. You can do this in multiple ways, that maybe you are testing more than one variations. Maybe you are trying to test more than one goals. Maybe you are telling yourself, out of these five goals, if any one of them comes out to be a winner, I would deploy it. So essentially, the intuition is that you are increasing the pool among which you are trying to find a pattern. And if the pool is larger, the chance that you just get an erroneous pattern, a false positive, sort of increases. So,
oh, I guess that makes sense, right? Like, I'm just thinking practically. See, I've got a control, and then I've got three variations, so it's an ABN test. Effectively running four variations, including control. I guess common sense tells me that if I'm running all four in parallel, then therefore there's higher chance of getting a false positive with four variations than, say, only two variations, right?
Yeah, so it's exactly like that. So if you have like n variations and you are like hypothesizing that any one of these wins, I'll deploy this, then essentially the chance that any one of them wins by chance, which is the false positive rate, it sort of goes multiplying. So if you have like two variations, it's from 5% to 10%. If you have 20 variations, then almost there is a certain chance that you'll get one variation just by chance winner. So what I tell people is, if you run an AA test with 20 variations, 20 AA variations, you can be sure that at least one of them will come out to be the winner.
Mm.
So that's the idea.
Got a question. So just say we're going from a frequentist perspective. I know you're a Bayesian fan, but let's just say, for argument's sake, from a frequentist perspective, does that mean that if you're running more variations in your ABN test, then decrease the alpha so that you decrease the likelihood of getting a false positive? Is that correct? So,
yeah.
Instead of accepting 95% statsig, you'd want to, in theory, go towards, say, 97, 98, 99, something like that. Does that make sense in theory?
Exactly. That's exactly what we do. So essentially, the quick heuristic is that you divide the alpha by the number of hypotheses you are testing. So if you are testing 10 hypotheses, then that 5% becomes 0.5%. So you are trying to go to 99.5. And that's the rough heuristic you need to follow.
Okay. That's interesting. Any other pointers you want to make about that for our audiences?
So what I want to say is that just generally start to get comfortable with this intuition that this does not just apply across variations. This applies across number of goals as well. This applies across sequential testing also. Like if you're seeing the result multiple times. So essentially, just this fundamental intuition of statistics, you should be aware that whenever I'm seeing a result, how big of a pool have I picked out that result from? And that should guide you how tight you should be with statistical significance. So that's the idea of multiple comparison.
Okay, cool. Thanks for that. No, that's very enlightening. I think in relation to that, we were going to talk about peaking and why that matters in test results. Do you want to just talk about, you know, what peaking is and why that matters for CROs?
Yeah, so it's a interesting special case of the multiple comparison problem.
Yeah.
It's basically when you peek into the test results multiple times throughout the test, essentially you increase the chance of getting a false positive.
Yep.
And I'll tell you the history behind that, basically how peaking and statistical significance got merged. Yep. Essentially, when we were running tests and controlled experiments in the 20th century, what generally a scientist or a drug trial would do is that they'll first collect all the samples. So they'll estimate the sample size, first collect all the sample, and then calculate the statistical significance only once. So then it's like a one-shot hypothesis that you have.
It's like we have a fixed sample, and we're based off that fixed sample, then we do the calculations, right?
Yeah, we first collect the entire sample and then we do the calculations.
Yeah.
But when we applied that method to A-B testing, it was very easy to just calculate the statistical significance live on the fly.
Yeah.
So that is what has started to now becoming known as sequential testing, and it has been differentiated quite a lot with fixed horizon testing in general understanding. But the interesting part there is that sequential testing allows you to peek into the results, but it needs to apply a correction to the probabilities to adjust for those. So that is the statistical interesting part of it. Yeah, please.
And just to clarify what audiences don't know, sequential testing, from my understanding, it's basically where as you're running the test, it's adjusting the statistical algorithm as you're running the test so that you can peak during the test. Whereas if you've got as opposed to like the example we gave before, the fixed the sample size, you obviously are going to get into issues if you're peaking during the test before you get your fixed sample size, right? Is that correct? Do you want to explain a bit more about that?
So in a fixed horizon test, essentially you are required to wait at least till that predetermined sample size is met. But sequential testing allows you that you can look at this probability to beat baseline on the fly and close the test as early as you see a winner. So it lets you save sample sizes. It's obviously much more desirable. And you can it's about the stopping. So even in a fixed horizon test, if you're looking at the probabilities, just peaking is not the problem. But the moment it crosses 95 and you stop the test, that is not allowed in fixed horizon testing. In sequential testing, they have made the correction to probabilities so that you can peak comfortably as many times as you want. And it is being taken care of by the system. So
I think the only kind of downside, well, it's probably not a downside with our, you know, level of technology, but doesn't it require a lot of computational power to do this if you're doing it on the fly?
No, it is pretty comfortably a formula, basically. And in the past, I've seen in the past 3-4 years, a lot of solutions to peaking corrections have come up. But essentially, they make a compromise in terms of how early you can get a winner and stuff. So essentially, with peaking corrections, they delay the winner a bit. And the compromise is on that front. But otherwise, it's not computationally very intensive. It's just a better algorithm. The trade-offs depend on what choice you are making. There is this always valid p-value solution that has a different sort of a trade-off. Then there is the solution that is being deployed, the alpha spending solution. It requires some more information from you that what is the maximum sample size you need. So there are different trade-offs, but overall it's a simple computation add that you make. Once the equation you have, once it's robust, it doesn't take a lot to calculate.
And how does this relate to what we just talked about 10 minutes ago about the multiple comparison problem, about getting the increase in the chances of getting the false positives with more variations in a test?
So it's like there you were seeing, you were making more hypotheses in terms of the different variations. Yeah. Here you are making more hypotheses across the test that I'll check at 100 visitors, 200 visitors, 300 visitors. You are essentially increasing the pool size of finding a winner. So that's the relation, but it is slightly less stringent than multiple comparison problem because in peaking, you don't need to make alpha by n. So if you are making 10 peaks, you don't need to directly go to a significance level of 99.5. That would be too stringent. You can go easier as well and still control the false positive rates. So that's the slight difference from it. So the solution to both problems are different, but the root of the problem is the same.
Okay. Any other pointers or maybe practical tips you'd like to give our audiences who aren't as statistically inclined?
I would give this advice that do check if you are continuously. So people choose one of the two ways. Either you run the test and just wait till the predetermined sample size. And even if you have the urge to peak very less and don't take a decision till you reach that predetermined sample size, or you apply a peaking correction to your statistics. So that way you would not have a lot of false winners in your test. So that's the summary.
I only work for a competing company, but I mean the platform we use, Optimizely, it does. Well, they purport to say they purport that they have something built in to prevent issues with peaking in their algorithm. Anyway, we won't get into that topic. but yeah, I since you're waiting for the competition, we want to avoid a potential lawsuit, but defamation charge. But that's what they report. So that's related to that that issue of peaking.
A lot of vendors have started providing a solution to that, and there are different solutions in the market, and they're very interesting in the trade-off. So I would suggest, we can definitely, I think case by case, you'll have to go when you see what solution for peaking is being provided.
Hmm.
And there's a very good article by Spotify there, and probably we can share it with our listeners that summarizes all the solutions on peaking and the trade-offs, essentially.
Cool. I think the other thing we wanted to discuss about is false discovery rate. I remember you talking about false discovery rates in your experimentation talk that you had 2 months ago, 1 or 2 months ago. Do you want to explain what exactly a false discovery rate is? Because it is different to a false positive rate. I think it's somewhat related. Can you explain what that is and why it matters to us as experimenters?
So it's a very interesting concept, actually, false discovery rates. And I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah.
So let me start by explaining by precisely defining false positive rates and then explaining how false discovery rates are different. So false positive rates are the more commonly known term and the more commonly measure of accuracy of an A-B test. And what false positive rates say is that if there is no impact on the target metric, then what is the chance that you get a winner just by chance from the A-B test? So,
I mean, we're assuming null hypothesis, right?
Assuming the null hypothesis.
Yeah,
that gives you the false positive rate. So if you are running 100 AA tests, then you can expect with a 5% false positive rate that five of those will come out to be winners.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So false discovery rates is exactly the opposite. And once you understand, you'll start to get why it matters more. It is the false discovery rates are the chance that if you have gotten a winner, then what was the probability that actually there was no impact on your metric? So your metric, the test was actually a bogus test. It was not a winner. What is the chance that if you have gotten the winner, what is the chance that it was a bogus winner? That's the false discovery rate.
Are you saying that it's actually going a step further than this whole false positive rate metric? So just to clarify for myself and maybe in our audiences, it's asking if you've declared a winner or found a winner, what's the chance of that winner being false in reality if you were to actually deploy that? Is that correct?
Yeah, precisely. So an easy way to understand the difference is a cause and effect analogy. Yep. So essentially, being the winner is the cause of the data that you're going to observe. And in the data, if you see the winner or not, is the effect. So false positive rates are conditioning on the cause and then telling you the probability of the effect. That the cause is that it is a bogus winner. It is a bogus test. There is no improvement. That is the cause. And the effect is that you are seeing a winner. So that's the false positive rate. And in a very Bayesian way, false discovery rates are like sort of going opposite. They're saying that if you have observed a winner, then what is the chance that it was actually bogus? So it's like sort of the Bayesian cousin of false positive rates.
You're kind of flipping the logic around, right? Yeah.
The direction around, yeah.
Yeah, direction around, yeah.
And that is, interestingly, what matters more, because you'll never know the underlying cause. That's what you're trying to study. You'll only know the effect. And as an experimenter, what should matter to you is that out of the number of winners I'm getting, no more than an X percent should be false.
Do you, like, you know, I'm completely new to this stuff, so do you, like, let's just sort of put it into practice. Like, would you have some sort of, percentage, stop gap where you say, okay, I'm only going to accept I want 90% of these winners that I declare to at least 90% of them to actually be true winners in the real world? Like, how do we sort of put some sort of boundaries around this
false
do you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, why you declare false and why you declare, you know, true.
So that's, I think you're asking a very interesting question, because that brings us the gap between false discovery rate and false positive rate. So firstly, to understand is that false positive rates can be directly controlled. The alpha that you're choosing in your test,
yeah,
that's the false positive rate, and you can directly choose it. You can set it to 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
False discovery rates are harder. Why? Because false discovery rates have this added component along with the false positive rate. They have this added component that how many good ideas are you actually running? So if you are only running one person, if you run 100 tests, but 99 of them were bad ideas that were not leading to a winner, and only one of them was a good idea, then your false discovery rate will be very high. Because you're getting almost five winners from those 99, and this one good idea is already a winner. So you can follow, right? You got six winners, but out of those, five were actually bogus. So your false discovery rate was 80%.
Wow.
So essentially, this number, this mix matters of good ideas and bad ideas. And Ronnie Kohavi also published a very interesting table in his recent paper on intuition busters, where he's trying to show the chance of making the winner and what is the false discovery rate that they are getting. So at 8% at Airbnb, the false discovery rate was around 25% or something of that sort. So what you need... Yeah. Do you want to ask a question?
No, I'm just sort of thinking like... I hope no boss isn't listening, but I mean, I could have... Who knows, like, I mean, hand on heart, who knows, like, how many tests that I declared were true and correct winners, how many of, like, that we actually deployed, you know, how many, what percentage of them were, what was the false discovery rate of them? I'm just sort of thinking, like, I'm just having a bit of a moment there. hopefully they're not listening to this podcast, but you know what I mean, like, just being honest with you, like, I'm just sort of thinking, like, let's just say in my career I've pushed out, I don't know, 20 winners, and then let's just say 80% of them were like BS. That means that 16 of them were just like duds, and then four of them moved the needle. Oh gosh.
What I can assure you is that that problem is something that scientists have been going through for the past 200 years. That how many of the studies that we have published, and 20 years later it was realized, oh, it was a false discovery.
Oh god.
So you are in safe hands that way. All scientists.
I'm hopefully it's all hidden in the noise and stuff. But I mean, like, what? This is a new concept to me. I mean, is this why is this not being talked about much in the CRO world? Because I've only heard you. Maybe I've heard you and Ronnie talk about it. I didn't really understand when I first heard about it. But I mean, this sounds to be like a true North Star kind of metric we should be taking more seriously. Why is this not being talked about more often?
So I'll tell you the reason and my hypothesis towards why it is not being talked about more. So the missing piece, if you get this prior estimate that how many of your ideas are winning ideas, then it is very easy to control false discovery rates. Why? If you have an accurate estimate of the prior, then you can back calculate the required false positive rate. So suppose an oracle comes and tells you that 20% of your ideas are good, 80% of them are bad. Then you can just simply use the Bayes rule to calculate that, okay, I want a false discovery rate of 5%, then the false positive rate should be this. And you can deploy that in your tests. It's not very difficult. The difficult part is to get an estimate of the prior. Because essentially now all the sort of debates, so you have no instrument to know accurately how many of your tests are winning. You can only guess it. And secondly, it leads to the Bayesian debate that never can that number be proved wrong. Like, there can be no evidence to that. It's an unfalsifiable number. So a lot of things go on there. Basically, the difficulty is in estimating this prior.
How would you know that in reality, though? Like, you know, this whole false discovery thing, like, it assumes that you know, you have to know what percentage of your tests that you've pushed out into the real world, like you productionized, are actually winning tests. Like, how the hell would you know that stuff? It's very hard to measure.
It's very hard to measure, and that's the problem. And that's the problem, even in my hypothesis, between the Bayesian and frequentist worlds.
Mm.
But essentially, what can be done is some good heuristics can be made, and some good guesses can be made to cut down your false discovery rates very significantly. Like, for example, if an organization is starting new, they should expect to have generally more good ideas because a lot of improvements can be made And as an experimentation effort becomes more mature, they should start to become conservative with their false positive rates, because now they know that good ideas are harder and harder to come by. So it can only be made a guess about, and there can be like industry standards or maybe some page levels. Like Ronnie tells us that cart abandonment problem is very hard. Like to reduce cart abandonment, it's very difficult to generate a good idea. So you need to go by some heuristics. By that, you can control false discovery rates to quite an extent, but it's very hard to exactly control that. So
Do any platforms out there, like, you know, VWO, AB Tasty, or whatever, do any of them include any of these?
So,
related to that? Like,
so essentially, we at VWO are working on it, and we are essentially wanting to give a plugin where if you can guess your prior, you'll be told a backtrack false positive rate value. Just you need to guess your prior and fill in that and the desired false discovery rate. The other place that I've seen this concept of false discovery rate is that Optimizely is controlling FDRs only within a test for multiple variations. So essentially, the FDR problem also happens when you are running multiple variations in a test. So there is a Ben-Hamini-Hochberg procedure that needs to know in advance how many hypotheses you are making. And then it sort of creates a complicated algorithm where the problem is somewhat tackled. But essentially, in your experimentation journey, as you are running more and more experiments, there you cannot apply that Ben-Hamini-Hochberg procedure, because there the number of hypotheses are changing as you are going. So that problem is still quite a bit unsolved, and it's sort of something that can be solved with heuristics by making good guesses on your success rate and then being conservative towards your
point. So the only issue there is that you're relying on the input of people that may even not know these, the prior. They're sort of kind of maybe somewhat using some heuristics, which is not perfect, but I guess it's whatever they have. Let's move on before my brain explodes with this information. I'm sort of thinking how many false discovery rates I've had. Why you should never stop tests early, even if they're failing. The reason why I wanted to talk about this one is because, you know, people talk about peaking and, you know, if a test is doing well, so you see, say a test is doing well and you're peaking. A lot of people in a lot of blogs I've read before in the past have said, well, you know, if you reach stat sig, you shouldn't just stop the test. You should, you know, keep it going for a little while, because you might be peaking. This is a bit different. This is in some ways the opposite, because this is like, well, you've got a losing test. You should just keep on running it for a while. Do you want to explain a bit more about this?
I would love to. So essentially what happens is, and I'm seeing this as a practice as well, a lot of people in the first few days, if the test is not giving a good result, they sort of shut it down. There are reasons to do that, but I want to draw the nuances and why, in what cases you should not do that. So essentially the first thing is that if you are killing a lot of the losing tests early, then you are not in for a lot of surprises. You are essentially just confirming what you're already knowing. So experimentation, to just explore the journey and explore the space of better ideas, you need to be ready to fail and be ready to invest, like let some amount of your investments go waste. Because what happens is that if you are killing all the losing tests early, then you are only operating in that safe zone where the tests are giving a very quick result and just very good. And there also sometimes a psychological factor comes in, that if I have a very strong hypothesis that this will work, then I'll tolerate the slight retrace as well. But essentially, if I don't believe in the idea, then I'm more likely to kill it early. So what I really want to say is that you cannot go with that selection bias into testing, because then you are just operating in the safe zone and losing out a lot of wins that might later bloom into some interest in learning. So that's one problem with that. The second problem with that is that you are also creating a bias over time. So suppose you are starting a test on Friday and suddenly on the weekend it is performing very well. So you let that test, all those tests that were started on Friday, you let them run. Those that were started on a Monday or a Tuesday, which had an initial downfall, then you don't let them run. So there is a bias to that as well. So that is why I generally condemn that practice. And the idea, I think, which has become accepted in the industry is let tests run for 2 weeks. But I also accept and say that if there are some crucial stakes involved, like for instance, if you understand why the performance is bad, or you have some crucial guardrail metric being hurt very bad, then you should go ahead and stop them. But it should not be a general practice.
In what kind of situations are you seeing this? Specifically, people this pattern of you seeing people stop a test early, is it in like very close to like revenue line parts of the website, like say checkout or like on an e-commerce product or a website or somewhere down like further end of the funnel of something, like a lead gen form or something? Are you seeing in specific areas of the funnel of a website, or are you just sort of seeing it across the board?
That's a very good question, and essentially I honestly do not have the data for it right now. Because we just saw it as a general pattern at VWO. We did not break it down to goals and did not go into an excessive that, but we know in a general frame that a lot of customers from a lot of CROs, they probably have that tendency in general. But I understand the point that you're making. If it is down the funnel, I think that is where you are hurting a crucial guardrail metric and you can be more conservative.
And yeah, there might be also like internal political pressure to, if up the revenue. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if you're pumping in millions of dollars through an e-commerce website and you're experimenting at the checkout stage or final stage of checkout, and you know your experiment's losing, say consecutively by say 20% first three four days, then I guess there can be quite a bit of kind of managerial pressure to like stop this test because it may not it's costing money, right?
Yeah, I definitely understand that, and that's why I added the caveat. But I feel that as a general practice, one should be aware that it comes at a cost, that you are essentially operating in a safer zone. And it sort of goes into sort of a cultural area of experimentation. So I'm understanding the pressure and the organizational pressure. And that's why this problem probably needs to be solved on an organizational level.
So
I can give you an example, a very interesting IBM Watson story. So there was this one young manager, and he sort of managed to lose $10 million in an entrepreneurial venture. And then when he went to, James Watson or some long time CEO of IBM, he went to him and he asked him politely that maybe you are expecting my resignation. And the boss says in return that you cannot be serious. We just invested $10 million educating you. So that's the sort of perspective you need towards failures, I feel, in
my view. Yeah. Well, I hope he learned a lot from it. That's a huge investment. I think this leads us to our last question, I think it was, which is about primacy and novelty effects and how they affect testing. Do you want to talk a bit more about what these are, like what are primacy and novelty effects, and how do they affect us in testing, and why should we care about that?
So there are interesting patterns that, firstly, you need to know that statistical significance does not take them into account, but you can always observe them from data. So what primacy effect is, when suppose you try out a new variation but your audience had a learning curve and they were used to the previous variation more.
Yep.
And hence, they sort of like take a time to essentially start using that new design. And you see a starting rise in engagement in users. Mm-hmm. And novelty is like entirely the opposite, that sometimes people are clicking on it something just because it is new. And yeah. otherwise, it doesn't hold validity. Like, for example, there was this very famous experiment at Microsoft that they changed the mail icon on the top left of the bar to Outlook.com. And suddenly, it showed an increased interaction because people were just confused. Why are we not going to mail? So they were clicking in.
I remember that one.
So primacy and novelty effects are something that you should know can exist with your test if there is a learning curve. And essentially, there are algorithmic ways to detect it also. But if you have a simple graph of the conversion rates daily, you can also like intuitively understand if you're seeing them in your test. And if they are there, the advice is that run the test longer, let the primacy and novelty stabilize. And maybe if required, then you can even chop off that initial time of stabilization for a more realistic estimate.
Are these related to also peaking as well? Like, because, you know, if you have the a novelty effect and it's doing really well for the first, I don't know, 1 or 2 weeks, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to stop the variation now. This is winning. This is related to peaking, right?
This is sort of it. It gets aggravated with peaking. It is related to it.
Yeah.
It causes the winner's curse as well, like sort of that the early winner and you deploy it, and hence it was more unlikely. But the deeper problem behind it, the deeper intuition is that essentially statistics assume that your underlying conversion rates are constant.
Yeah.
Whereas in practice, sometimes there are a lot of changing patterns to underlying conversion rates, that they're not stationary. So that's why all these problems get caused. So even week and weekday effect and all those things, because underlying conversion rates are going up and down. So that's the thing.
That's very insightful. Thanks. And I think the learning lesson for some of these questions that we've encountered is really to, obviously have a decent knowledge of working knowledge of statistics, but also for our CROs, but also to have a robust framework for when you're launching tests. So, you know, do your pre-test calculations, have a disciplined sort of way of testing, but also at a larger scale, you alluded to, and we won't talk about it here, but you alluded to, like, you know, having a culture of experimentation where, you know, management's not going to flip out because this test isn't doing well for the first 5 days or whatever. You know, these things do take a long time to build, and if they can be built into the culture that, you know, X amount of tests will lose, then they will see it as an investment. But then, you know, that it's really up to the experimenter or their team to sort of really champion the cause of experimentation. And, you know, Shane, any further thoughts for our audiences about what's been mentioned or anything like that?
Yeah, so I think as a closing thought, and towards what you were also saying, how all these things are connected, I think what is really going on in the industry right now is something that has not happened in the past, that the business world and the science world are getting infused with experimentation. Mm. Now we are really, like, the business mindset is coming face to face with the scientific mindset.
Yeah.
And that is the culture change that we are requiring, and we are trying to find a way in between. Because a scientist has always worked very differently, and a businessman always worked very differently. And that's what we are probably looking at, and it'll take a while for businesses to adopt that scientific mindset. But I think that's where we are headed with experimentation.
No, it's very exciting times. It's good that we can, you know, have a very kind of, at least with you and I, talk about a very sort of scientific framework of things, but also bear in mind that, you know, there is business objectives here, but look, it's been very good having you on the podcast. Ishan, how can people contact you?
They can contact me by my email, ishan.goyal@wingify.com.
Yep.
And I am available on LinkedIn, very keen to talk to all people. And feel free to drop me a message, and we can definitely chat up on statistics anytime.
Yeah, awesome. And we've also got a cool sounding blog. Was it Bagels for Thought? Was it? What was the URL?
It is bagelsforthought.blog. Just a second. It's bagelsforthought.ghost.io with a hyphen in between the three words. So essentially, I have been writing that blog. Now I'm going to write on statistics with VWO. So we are going to very soon launch a formal blog on statistics where I'll be talking about the entire story of experiment.
And when is that coming out?
We are very probably in the next 2 weeks. I'll be launching on LinkedIn.
Cool.
And I'll be sharing all my learnings and thoughts on experimentation.
Awesome. Hopefully, by the time this podcast comes out, we'll have a few of your blog articles out there, and good to get your name out. So thanks a lot for being on the podcast, and we'll hopefully have you in the future. Catch you around.
Yeah, and thanks a lot for inviting me. It was great chatting up with you.
No worries.
I had an amazing time.
Cool.
Great. Thank you, Richard.
This is Romo Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week, we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch.